Arcee, are we calling the roll?
Yes. So we have Assemblymember Levine, present. Assemblymember Zebrowski, present. Assemblymember Weprin, present. Assemblymember Bronstein is present. Assemblymember Court is present. Assemblymember Steck is present. Assemblymember Seawright is present. Assemblymember Joyner is present. Assemblymember Abenanti is present. Assemblymember Wallace is present. Assemblymember Walker is present. Assemblymember Cruz is present. Assemblymember McMahon is present. Assemblymember Matanes is present. And Assemblymember Rajkumar is present. Ranker Montesano is present. Assemblymember Norris is present. Assemblymember Walsh is present. Assemblymember Burns is present. Assemblymember Brown is present. And Assemblymember Tanousis is present.
Thank you. Thank you, Darcy. And that was Darcy Lindgren, our committee clerk. And I'm very fortunate to work with her as my legislative director. Good morning, all. I want to thank the speaker for providing us with an hour and a half, which is an extraordinarily long time for any committee meeting. And I also want to thank Speaker Carl Hasty for his steadfast dedication to American due process. So let me thank as well all staff who put this together and all the members of the Judiciary Committee. Each member spent a lot of time with me in informal discussions about the best ways for us to proceed. And that goes for all members, Republicans and Democrats. The format for today will be this. I'm going to make some opening remarks, and then my friend, neighbor, and colleague, Ranking Member Michael Montesano, will make some opening remarks. I will then introduce the extraordinarily talented group of attorneys who we will be working with. Then committee members will each have 3 minutes to ask questions or interact with the attorneys. And I regret it's not more than 3 minutes, but there are 21 of us. So given the time constraints, that's the way it's got to be. Before I actually begin with opening remarks, let me just mention that Davis Polk, our attorneys, are establishing a hotline for anyone who has information or is a witness or a potential witness to reach out. The speaker had tasked me as the chair of this committee with leading an impeachment investigation of the governor of the state of New York. And I look forward certainly to working with the committee members on this important investigation. Specifically, we have been tasked with determining whether evidence exists to support a finding that the governor has engaged in conduct which merits impeachment under the New York State Constitution and under the laws of the state of New York. We will carry on our responsibilities fairly and with due process for all involved. The speaker has directed us to examine all credible allegations, including but not limited to, and here the key is including but not limited to, did the governor use his office to sexually harass or assault women who were his employees? Did he direct staff to unlawfully withhold or misrepresent information that was required to be reported to the state legislature or other governmental entities regarding the effects of COVID-19 on New Yorkers? Did he direct or have knowledge of executive personnel withholding information regarding safety concerns about New York State bridges? Or did he direct or have knowledge of executive personnel attempting to suppress related investigations? As part of my responsibility, the speaker charged me with the task of retaining counsel, independent counsel, to represent this committee. I spent a considerable amount of time in that process. I spoke with many extraordinary lawyers, and I determined that our committee will best be served by working with the prestigious law firm of Davis Polk. Davis Polk is one of the premier enforcement and investigation law firms in the world. They have unparalleled experience investigating high-profile allegations of fraud, corruption, obstruction, and other matters of extreme sensitivity. They've been involved in legislative inquiries into matters ranging from oversight of corporate America to the recent impeachment hearings in D.C. They are skilled at scoping and conducting investigations in a fair, efficient, and expeditious manner. They've also conducted hundreds of high-profile fraud and corruption investigations in recent years. And in just the last 3 years alone, Davis Polk has conducted more than 20 sensitive investigations into allegations of sexual misconduct. These matters have ranged from representing audit committees of public companies charged with investigating allegations regarding the conduct of senior executives and other employees, to representing victims of sexual abuse and harassment, to reviewing and enhancing clients' policies and procedures around sexual misconduct and harassment in the workplace, and promoting workplace civility. I will, after Ranking Member Montesano speaks, be introducing the individual attorneys who are here. And finally, let me say this, that due process is not just a precept. It's not just at the heart of what makes us New Yorkers tick. It's at the heart of our American democracy as well. And I thank every member of this committee for remaining judicious in their pursuit of the truth. Ranking Member Montesano, your turn.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. For those who don't know me, my name is Michael Montesano. I represent the 15th Assembly District in Nassau County, and I serve as the ranking member of this Judiciary Committee. I appreciate Chairman Levine's comments and willingness to maintain an open dialogue with our members of the committee. I now turn my attention to the investigation before this committee. My Assembly colleagues, and in particular the Republican members of this committee, expect a fair and impartial investigation into the actions of this governor. The allegations before this committee are as disturbing as they are serious. Due to the sensitive nature of the work this committee will soon be embarking on, I ask the chairman to consider requiring members of this committee to meet in person so as not to subject the committee to hacked Zoom accounts or leaked information. We have an obligation as public officials and as attorneys to maintain the strictest of confidentiality with regard to the work of this committee. As for the substance of the allegations before this committee, everything is on the table. You have and will continue to hear about the need to investigate claims of sexual harassment against the governor, which currently number at least 9 individuals, but increase on a weekly or even daily basis. It is imperative that this law firm thoroughly investigate these troubling claims of pervasive sexual harassment and the perpetuation of hostile work environment. As I mentioned previously, everything is on the table. It is incumbent that your law firm not only center its investigation on the claims of sexual harassment, but that it report on the executive's handling and reporting of nursing home death during the COVID-19 pandemic. To refresh your recollection, the governor's March 25th, 2020 directive stated that no resident shall be denied readmission or admission to the nursing home solely based on a confirmed or suspected diagnosis of COVID-19, provided they are medically stable. As a result of this directive, countless thousands of New Yorkers died in nursing homes. However, the exact number of individuals who died in nursing homes at the hands of this governor and his mandates is still unclear, as we learned in a report by the Attorney General on nursing home response to COVID-19 dated January 28, 2021. The Attorney General conducted investigations into complaints of neglect at nursing homes related to COVID-19. In fact, the governor's administration admitted to falsifying the nursing home data. Ultimately, the AG's report determined that the Department of Health had undercounted nursing home deaths by approximately 50%. I implore this law firm to thoroughly investigate the executive's intentional manipulation of nursing home data and provide this committee with a summary of the actions that this governor took to cover up deaths in nursing homes. I also ask you to provide a thorough report on the parameters of the contract and royalties from the governor's book, which he authored mid-pandemic, before the details of the grave conditions facing our nursing home residents were brought to light. I ask that members of this committee be updated regularly, preferably weekly, of its findings. With regard to an investigation into sexual harassment complaints, I ask that this firm provide the committee with a full workup after interviewing each victim, including a transcript of the deposition and any supporting documents and evidentiary materials. I do not want to see a process where this committee is not routinely updated on the results of the investigation, and a month goes by without any status updates. I also ask that the three attorneys appointed to this post consider dividing up their search and have a specific attorney in charge of each issue so that they can work expeditiously and can be held accountable by each issue investigated. I thank you, and I respectfully request a reservation of time for a closing statement. Thank you, Chairman.
Your request for a reservation for closing time is granted, Counsel. I'm listening. I have listened to your suggestions, and we will continue to discuss them. Thank you, Assemblymember Montesano. And now it's my privilege to speak to you briefly about the profiles of the lawyers who will be lead counsel in this matter, independent counsel. Combined, they have nearly 20 years of high-level prosecutorial experience and over half a century's worth of experience conducting sensitive investigations of this sort. In alphabetical order, and again, my pleasure to introduce Greg Andres, recently returned to Davis Polk after his service as a member of special counsel Robert Mueller's team investigating Russian government efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election and related matters. He served as the lead trial lawyer in the successful prosecution of Paul Manafort in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. Previously, Mr. Andres had served as a federal prosecutor in New York and in Washington, D.C. for more than a dozen years, where he held a series of senior supervisory positions. From 2010 to 2012, he served as a deputy assistant attorney general in the criminal division of the Department of Justice, where he supervised the fraud and appellate sections, among others. He's also worked as liaison to the United States Congress on various issues and testified on several occasions on white-collar crimes. He previously served as chief of the criminal division in the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York from 2007 to 2010, where he supervised more than 100 federal prosecutors in a wide range of investigations and prosecutions. He has experience with investigations involving sexual misconduct, both in the government and in private practice, including the representation of victims of abusive behavior. He is a nationally recognized trial lawyer and has been recognized as one of the nation's premier lawyers by numerous publications. I also want to introduce with great pleasure Martine Beeman, who also spent several years as a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, where she conducted numerous investigations and trials, including in that office's public corruption unit. Since returning to Davis Polk, she has conducted over 100 sensitive investigations, including over 20 matters in which she has represented companies, boards, and individuals on sexual misconduct matters, including investigations, cultural assessments, and related compliance. Her other notable investigations have included allegations of public corruption, foreign corrupt practices, and financial fraud. She has consistently been recognized as one of the top white-collar practitioners in the country and one of the nation's premier women in litigation. It's also a great pleasure to introduce to you Angela Burgess, co-chair of Davis Polk's White-Collar Defense and Investigations Group. She has represented leading clients in some of the most high-profile and complex white-collar and regulatory matters in recent years. Her practice has focused on investigations of fraud, corruption, obstruction of justice, and other financial crimes. She has been involved in over 100 of these investigations during her tenure at the firm. She has also been involved in at least 20 investigations of sexual misconduct and has been recognized as one of the top anti-corruption practitioners in the United States and is routinely recognized as one of the premier women in white-collar practice. Counsel are going to examine documents and other materials, meet with the witnesses to assess whether there's evidence that the governor has engaged in conduct that justifies articles of impeachment. Discussions relating to that will be held in executive session in the first instance, and we are certainly prepared to schedule any such sessions when appropriate. The question may come up about timeline. At this early stage, it's not possible to say precisely how long the investigation will take. After all, these counsel have been working with us for only a week, actually less than a week right now. Given the breadth and seriousness of the issues under investigation, we expect that the timing will be in terms of months rather than weeks. We have asked Davis Polk to prioritize the investigation and to work expediently, and they will. As you know, there is very little precedent for impeachment in New York. We are mindful of the due process necessary to ensure the fairness of this process to everyone, the victims, the witnesses, and the governor, and to do so in a transparent manner so that all New Yorkers are informed. So I don't know whether any of our attorneys want to briefly address us at the present time before we turn it over to the members of the committee. If so, now is a good time to speak. And if not, they will certainly be happy to engage in colloquy, as we call it, with the members of the committee. So with that in mind, it's now time for members of the committee to ask any questions, make any statements, and again, 3 minutes each, and there is a time clock. Who's going to go first? I'm sure we have someone.
Hello, I think I've been unmuted.
Yes, and this is Jennifer Rajkumar.
Thank you to our outside counsel for appearing this morning, and thank you to our Judiciary Chair, Chuck Levine, for leading this process. My question is about implicit bias. It is not uncommon for attorneys to allow personal or professional passions about a subject to alter their sense of appropriate professional behavior, especially when the situation is sensitive or high stress. Even the most well-intentioned of attorneys can allow pride of career advancement, outside pressure caused by media reports or political leaders, or even personal implicit biases to interfere with professional judgment. Can you assure this committee that your investigation will be based only on facts and law? Facts and law and nothing else. How are you going to control for your implicit biases? Because we all have them, every individual. In other words, how are you going to self-regulate for your implicit biases, whatever they may be? What objective standards will you be using to determine and to ensure the investigation is grounded in truth and is in no way compromised by implicit bias, media, or other pressure in this high stress and highly consequential investigation?
Well, thank you for that question. I'm happy to start off and invite my colleagues to comment as well. I think we will conduct an investigation and a process that is free from implicit bias. And we will regulate that by speaking among our own team. We will have a diverse team that's working on this matter, and we'll collaborate with all of our partners here, Angela, Martine, and I, as long, and in addition to the other lawyers who will be working on this matter. And we have routinely worked on matters where there is substantial press attention and pressure and the like, and we're accustomed to working under those circumstances. And in terms of objective standards, we won't be working in a vacuum, but instead together with the committee in sharing with you our process, our next steps, and the information that we gather in many respects in real time, or certainly on a regular basis, such that we will have input from a wide range of individuals, including, of course, all the members of this committee. I would invite my colleagues, Angela and Martine, to supplement that.
Thanks, Greg. This is Martine Beeman. Thank you for that excellent question. And I think that the question of implicit bias is an excellent one. It's something that we pay close attention to, both in investigations and in our everyday practice, and one that we're very focused on at all times. As Greg said, I think that we'll spend a great deal of time with one another, spending time talking about our findings and conclusions and with the members of our team, and especially with the committee. And I hope and expect that that process will be a check on any implicit biases that we all have. And that is the process that we follow, not just in this investigation, but in all of the high profile investigations that we conduct as part of our practice here at Davis Polk. Angela, anything to add?
I think that both of you covered that very well. And I do add my thanks to the question, because I think it's an important one and one that we do have in mind, as Martine said, in all of our investigations, and we'll certainly have it top of mind on this one.
Thank you.
Now, as we're waiting for the next member to speak, I will be recognizing the members by stating their names. Anyone who is listening to this doesn't have the ability to see who is speaking. So pardon me if I again restate the names. Those of us who are part of this Zoom conference can see each other, but the general public can only listen to what we are saying.
Chuck, you unmuted me, but I don't know if you meant to recognize me.
You know, Phil, I can't, I don't see, oh, now I see the hand. Okay. So now I want to recognize Phil Stepp.
So sexual harassment is often sensationalized, but there are other closely related issues that are just as serious. I want to know whether you see the following as within the scope of your investigation. Three things. First, sex discrimination, as described in the well-known Supreme Court case of Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins, a 1989 decision, wherein hiring women based on their appearance and requiring them or suggesting that they dress a certain way, and that being perceived as a vehicle for advancement within the executive chamber. Two, retaliation, releasing the personnel file to the public of one of the complainants against the governor. And three, hostile work environment.
Assemblymember Stack, this is Martine Beeman. Thank you for that question. I saw that you had tweeted about PwC versus Hopkins, and I'm familiar with that case, and I agree wholeheartedly that that would be applicable here. Of course, subject to the committee's view, we would expect that all three of those subject matters that you have referenced here would be part of this investigation, and all are important aspects of any investigation with respect to sexual harassment or any aspect of sexual misconduct.
So I have another question, Chuck. I don't think I used up my 3 minutes. Is that all right?
Yes, as long as you don't use up your 3 minutes.
So I'm wondering if any of the attorneys had any experience in New York State penal law. For example, the definition of coercion in the New York penal law, having been a state court prosecutor, there are a lot of very interesting provisions in the penal law. And would you understand this investigation to embrace coercive threats by the governor against public officials who exposed or tried to expose what turned out to be falsification of nursing home deaths? It's sort of the same thing as the retaliation claim in the sexual harassment context.
I think the answer to that is yes, that we would view that as within the scope that has been articulated.
And I would just add to that while I spent the primary time as a federal prosecutor, that I did interact with state law enforcement entities as well. And some of the prosecutions that I was involved in involved prosecutions of state law. So we're certainly familiar with the New York penal law.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Phil. And Phil, not to interject myself, but as you know, I spent many, many years in the criminal courts of the city of New York and the criminal courts of the state of New York. So I think between the our counsel and me and you and some of the other members, we'll have a good handle on state law. That's for sure. Our next questioner is Assemblymember Monica Wallace. Monica?
Good morning. Good morning. First, I just want to say thank you, Chair Levine, and to the speaker for this inquiry. Like everyone on the committee, I am deeply committed to the rule of law and to due process. These are serious allegations, and I'm glad the speaker has decided to open an investigation. And I want to commend the chair for doing an excellent job picking, obviously very learned and experienced counsel. In order for the public to have confidence in our results, the public has to have confidence in the process and in the investigation. So I just want to draw your attention to one question here. You might have seen there have been some reports in the media initially when you were first elected about concerns regarding potential conflict of interest. Many of us on this committee are lawyers, and we all know that all law firms have a process to address and protect against potential conflicts of interest and the appearance of conflict. I'm wondering if, not only for the benefit of this committee, but also the benefit of the public, if you can kind of go through that process with us and help us understand some of the measures that you've taken to make sure that there is no conflict of interest in the firm. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And as you do recognize, we have a very robust process within Davis Polk for ensuring that for any assignment that we take on, that we do not begin that matter with any conflicts of interest. And so we do a search throughout the firm and through our management committee to ensure that there are no conflicts of interest that would either as a matter of ethics or appearance create an issue. And we embarked on that process here and concluded that there was no conflict.
Thank you.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you, Monica. Our next question is from Assemblymember Latrice Walker.
Good morning.
I'm sorry. Latrice, if you let me use up 5 seconds of your time. I'm just joking. Time is going to
You can give me back 15 seconds if you take five.
That's a deal. Good negotiating. I want to mention as well that the Assembly also vetted all the law firms that were considered. And we certainly found no conflict of interest whatsoever with Davis Polk. Thank you. Latrice, that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to the distinguished attorneys who are joining us as we embark on this very historic occasion. We've all understood that these are extremely serious allegations that we will be deliberating on. As the chairman indicated, due process is a basic tenet of our American jurisprudence and democracy. And it's something as an attorney, as members of this committee, we took an oath to ensure and will make sure that we are hitting that mark under all circumstances. It has been imperative that we stayed above the noise, as indicated by Michelle Obama, and not allow this to play out in political theater or the court of public opinion. We know that New York State is a very diverse state. And as attorneys, as communities of color, we are also very much so committed to ensuring that fairness, justice, and equity is served here. And in respecting that diversity, I would like to know what Davis Polk will be doing to ensuring that the top members of its legal administration will be as diverse as the great state of New York is. And how will we be ensuring that throughout this process, we will be deploying attorneys within your firm of all races, ethnicities, creeds, et cetera, throughout this process so that we are all ensuring that diversity is a mainstay. Hello.
Sorry, I was on mute. So as you can imagine, again, thank you for that question. The firm is extremely committed to creating a very diverse environment, not only within the firm itself, but we give consideration to that on all the matters we staff, including with respect to any high-profile matters such as this, both for the reasons that Martine stated before in terms of making sure that we have a team that is of diverse backgrounds and can bring different thought leadership to our work. So we have very much in mind in terms of the staffing of our team, including the high-profile, the leaders of those teams, to make sure that it is a diverse team, and we'd be happy to share those details as we go forward with you to give you every assurance that we are staffing it in that way.
Thank you. I look forward to meeting those members of your team. Again, we are considering circumstances that, representing a community where criminal justice has never necessarily been the most friendliest. There are a number of individuals who've gone through wrongful convictions, et cetera, within the communities that I represent. And so, I pay particular care to ensuring that those voices are heard as well as respected throughout this process. And so again, I do thank you for your time and for all of the energies and the expertise that we're gonna be working with together with here. But again, we are dealing with life, liberty, reputations, legacies, et cetera. And just like I fight for that throughout criminal justice reform in the state assembly, just because we are dealing now with the governor of the great state of New York, I think that the same level of care and attention to detail and to our civil rights is just as important in this circumstance as in any other circumstance. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Latrice, and thank you, Angela. Next, we will recognize Assemblymember Latoya Joyner.
Thank you, Chairman. So I have a couple of questions. This may be early on in the process, but hopefully within the next coming couple of weeks, we will get answers on this. And it's more so in terms of process. So I was wondering, I have two questions for now. The deadline for when documents must be turned over to this investigative body, that's the first question. And then the second question is, how do we handle new evidence, new allegations? Is there a timeline for new submissions? And these questions are more geared towards process and timing and expectation, because there is an expectation that we get to work quickly and responsibly. So just trying to get a sense of the priorities and how will we get to the intended results. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for that question, Assemblyperson Joyner. We'll start gathering documents as quickly as we can. Sometimes it depends on the volume of documents from different institutions or people that were gathering those documents. We've already had some discussions with some of the relevant parties here about preserving documents so that we can gather those quickly. In terms of deadlines, we'll work with as much speed as we can, with the understanding that we'll be both thorough and fair in gathering those documents. So the short answer is there won't be a particular deadline necessarily, but we'll try to get those documents as quickly as possible so that we can both process them and understand them for the purposes of then conducting interviews of the relevant witnesses who may be able to shed additional information about those documents. In terms of new evidence, as we mentioned, we expect to be working closely with the committee. And so to the extent that there are additional allegations or additional areas of inquiry that become relevant, we'll consult with the committee on those issues and decide how to proceed.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, LaToya. And before I call upon Assemblymember Catalina Cruz for some questioning, this might be an appropriate time for me to mention that I served on the governor several days ago a notice of non-retaliation. In other words, putting the governor on notice that he and his employees and allies should take no steps towards intimidating any witness or any potential witness. So with that in mind, now I'm going to call on Assemblymember Catalina Cruz.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of quick questions. Some are related to the law and some are related to centered around ensuring that the women you're interviewing are in a safe space. So when you talked initially, I believe it was Monica who talked about conflicts of interest. I have to be honest, I am a lawyer myself, and it felt like the biggest lawyer answer. And so I would love a little bit of an expansion for the folks who are not lawyers, who are possibly listening in, and for the press, who I'm sure is crazy tweeting about it right now, and explaining not only how you made sure before that there were no conflicts of interest, and as we're moving forward with the investigation, there is a possibility that a new allegation might come out, a new witness might come out, a new issue might come out, where there may be a conflict of interest with an issue within your firm. How is the firm prepared, or what steps are set up in place to deal with a new conflict of interest that could arise? And then the second question is, I'd love to know if any of you three or anybody else in the firm has received training on trauma-informed care, and what are the steps that are going to be taken when interviewing the women who have come forward and anyone else who has come forward to ensure that we are not re-victimizing them in any way, or that they are, or that if something worse comes out during the investigation, that they are given resources or referrals or et cetera, because it isn't just about finding the truth. It's also about making sure that whoever comes forward, we're not just leaving them hanging in the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't I take the first part of the question, and then I'll hand it over to Martine, who together with me has conducted a number of very sensitive investigations, and we can give you a sense of how we handle these matters, because we do appreciate the extreme sensitivity with respect to the women who are coming forward, and we want to make sure that that's handled in the most appropriate and fair and safe environment as possible, so that they can share with us their experiences. But I'll let Martine elaborate on that as well. With respect to the conflict of interest process, as you can imagine, as any large firm would have, we have a conflict system that information is entered into that searches basically all matters at the firm, both past and present, with respect to identifying any conflicts that could arise. And so we did that here on an expedited basis. When we were asked about, you know, potentially taking on this role, we also have a management committee and a general counsel group that also reviewed the information, and we looked at our contacts and conflicts and determined that there was none. I hope that helps provide a little bit more information, but that's the process that we go through for any matter.
And what are you gonna do if it, and I'm sorry, my time has expired, but I didn't hear an answer on what happens now if another, if through the process a conflict arises, what are the steps that the firm's going to take to safeguard the investigation?
Sure, no, thank you for that. Yes, we will have a process in place. We do ordinarily, if there is a different, if something should come up where we would think that there is another party or person or entity that would be relevant in our investigation, we would search our conflicts database again and go through effectively the same process that we did it as we commenced this. So we will have that.
As the committee to be informed right away if that does arise, because I assume that we as a committee are going to want to have input on what steps you take.
Of course, we would absolutely do that and certainly notify you in the event that there was anything that was at all creating a conflict. Assemblymember Cruz, I wanted to answer the second part of your question with respect to the treatment of the victims who come forward. And I think as was mentioned at the outset of the introductions, as part of our experience in handling these types of matters, we do represent victims of not only sexual harassment, but sexual abuse. And so we are quite sensitive to how people can be re-victimized in telling their stories, in having to go back through the description of the events that traumatized them in the first instance. And so we are familiar with resources that are available to victims to assist them in working through these issues. And we do have those resources at hand and are happy to work with victims to the extent that they'd like to hear from us with respect to those. And we do think through the protocols with respect to victims who are interested in speaking to us. And we would, of course, like to speak to anyone who would be willing to come forward to speak to us. And we will handle those interviews with the greatest of sensitivities, and we'll put into place any processes that they feel comfortable with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Martine, Angela, and Catalina. And before I call upon, or as I'm calling upon, our colleague Rebecca Seawright to speak, I just want to mention that in the recent days there was a very fascinating and interesting article in the New York Law Journal dealing with the question of conflict with respect to David Pope, and the leading experts have all weighed in, and they include Rebecca Reuf, Stephen Gillers, and Bruce Green, that there is no conflict of interest here whatsoever. And now I'll call upon my colleague, Assemblymember Rebecca Seawright.
Thank you, Chair Levine and the Speaker's Council that's on today. As my colleagues have said, this is a very important investigation. So I have one question with three parts, all relating to process of the inquiry. One, what methods of getting information from the governor will you utilize? Interviews, interrogatories, depositions, et cetera. Two, what will be the scope of witnesses to be interviewed? Current staff, former staff, people outside of government, including the private sector, or retired? And three, will there be progress reports? And if so, how often? Or will there be one report at the end? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. In terms of the first part of the question, in terms of methods, we'll use all methods available to us and all tools for gathering information. So that will include interviews. It could involve interrogatories if we found that to be necessary. Certainly we'll request documents and we'll consider the use of subpoenas to ensure that the documents are produced and that there isn't any obstruction or any destruction of documents in the course of providing and preserving documents. As I mentioned in response to an earlier question, we've had some initial discussions about the preservation of documents so that relevant parties are aware of the fact that we've been following up to ask for those documents in a more formal way. In terms of witnesses, we won't be limited, whether it's current staff or prior staff, folks who've retired or not, whether they have an official position in the government or otherwise. We'll follow all the leads from our investigation and interview any necessary witnesses As Chairman Levine mentioned, we are interested in setting up a hotline or some process that will allow individuals to come forward to reach out to us to let us know about individuals who may have information that's relevant to our inquiry. And in terms of progress reports, we're committed to doing that on whatever basis the committee decides. I know Assemblyman Montesano mentioned early on the need for that. That's something that we've talked about internally. And again, we're happy to work with the committee on the appropriate reporting timeframe and structure. We do not anticipate that we're going to go away, do an investigation in an X number of months or time come up and just provide a report. We understand this process to be iterative and for us to be interacting with the committee on a regular basis.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Rebecca. And Dan Court, I know your hand function isn't working, so you can't raise your hand, but I want to recognize next Assemblymember David Weckren. And Dan, that will give you a chance to get your question good and ready. Assemblymember David Weckren.
Good morning, and I too want to thank the Speaker and Chair Levine for going to extraordinary efforts to make sure that due process and impartiality prevails throughout this process. I want to ask a question of the lawyers relating to the simultaneous investigation that the Attorney General is doing. And how are you going to, and I understand the it's been brought up a number of times about not putting certain witnesses through, you know, questioning unnecessarily a second time. How are you going to deal with the question of facts that may or may not be different from either witnesses or non-cooperative witnesses who will not cooperate with this investigation? But there are facts that may be determined or come out of the Attorney General's investigation, but they may be different than what you may determine. How would you deal with that situation?
Thank you for that question. We certainly have a substantial amount of experience, investigations, parallel investigations. Often the matters that we're involved in involve numerous investigative bodies or regulators. As federal prosecutors, Martine and I also have been involved in investigations where there is a component part, whether it's a parallel state investigation or an investigation by a legislative body. So we will work to coordinate to the extent possible with the relevant investigators in this case, whether it's the New York Attorney General's office or other offices, which isn't to say that we won't also maintain the independence of this investigation. I'm sure the Attorney General's investigators also want to maintain their own independence. So we will coordinate to the extent possible, make sure that we're not hindering or obstructing their investigation to the extent possible. But we will plan to proceed given the time frame and coordinate to the extent possible.
Okay, in my 42 seconds I have left, how will you deal with the situation where the Attorney General may have interviewed a witness that does not want to cooperate with this investigation? Are you going to, assume facts from the Attorney General as being accurate, or how would you independently determine that they may not be accurate if you have a witness that's not willing to cooperate with our investigation?
Thanks, Assemblymember. I think first and foremost, we're very hopeful that all of the witnesses will consider cooperating with us. You know, we understand that questions have been raised, but we're very hopeful that through this process of discussion with all of you as assembly members and with coming to know the integrity of our process, that ultimately witnesses will become comfortable and will wish to speak to us independently. Then, hopefully we won't have to cross the bridge that you have that you have suggested. But if not, then I think we'll have the benefit of reviewing, if the passage of time comes, then we'll have the benefit of reviewing the other report, and then we can discuss with the committee how to assess that evidence. But we're very hopeful that all of the witnesses will agree to speak to us in the first instance, and we're willing to work with their counsel and proceed in any way that they feel most comfortable in order to try to do that in the first instance.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Martine and Greg as well. Assemblymember Dan Quart.
Assemblymember Weprin asked my exact question, and the attorneys provided the answer, so I will not take up more time. That was the question. I was interested in the level of coordination and avoiding redundancy of witness testimony, especially in the context of the allegations of sexual harassment, but the attorneys answered the questions that was the exact question. So I appreciate the answer and cede back my time to the chair.
Dan, thank you. Are you sort of telling me I should have called on you before David Weprin?
No, the important thing is the committee and the public got the information. Good work, Dan.
Our next assembly member to speak is our colleague, Mary Beth Walsh.
Good morning, thank you. My experience shows that one of the most important things in an investigation is properly scoping it. So I wanted to pick up on a comment that was made a little bit earlier and just kind of dig into that a little bit more. We've talked about the idea that everything is on the table, but we've also identified that we're dealing with the sexual harassment piece, the nursing home piece. What if there is something, obviously, if another complainant comes forward alleging sexual harassment, obviously that would be considered as part of the scope. If there is some other indication that there's been an interference with an investigation, perhaps that's not the nursing home investigation, but something else, for example, would that be part of what this investigation would take a look at? So something completely separate. This governor has been in office for a period of time. From the Moreland Commission to J-COPE, there have been other issues that have arisen with regard to the governor, perhaps. Could that be part of this investigation? As my colleague, Mr. Montesano, said, everything is on the table. I want to make sure that it really is. And the second thing is just a comment more than a question. When you conduct your interviews, it would be my preference, and I think that of some of my colleagues, if not all, that we would have access to the source material, not simply a report of that interview. So if there is a recording, if there is a videotape, I would want to have access to that to make credibility assessments and to get a fuller picture of what you saw when you were doing your investigation. When I served on the ethics committee for the assembly, that was something that we also wanted to have access to. So that's by way of more of a comment, but please, if you could address the question that I raised as far as scope, and thank you.
Sure, Assemblyperson Walsh, thank you for that question. The short answer is that the mandate that we've been given is including but not limited to specific allegations and issues. And so our practice would be if there were new investigative streams or additional allegations that went into new areas, we would expect to bring those issues to the committee and have a discussion and work at the direction of the committee about whether to pursue those as well. Again, we view this as a completely iterative process, and as counsel to the assembly, we'll be advising on any new developments and take direction on that. As to your second question about source information, it certainly will be our practice not to limit in any way the evidence that we make available to the committee. So if it's evidence that we've gathered and it's relevant and the committee is interested in seeing it, we will absolutely make that available.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Beth. And before I call on our colleague Karen McMahon, let me point out that many members of the Judiciary Committee have already had experience serving on the Ethics Committee, which I chaired for 5 years. And I hope I'm not leaving anyone out, but Monica Wallace, Catalina Cruz, Mary Beth Walsh, Mike Norris, Mike Montesano, and Ken Zabrowski have all served at one time or another on the Ethics Committee. And at the Ethics Committee, we always had access to firsthand reports, source documents, and we will certainly continue in that tradition. Thank you. Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Mary Beth. And now I call upon Karen McMahon.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for all that work that you've done thus far to start a fair and open investigation process. Excuse me. And thank you to our counsel for agreeing to undertake this really sensitive and important investigation. As has been stated by a couple of my colleagues, this investigation really shouldn't play out in the media or the court of public opinion, but at the same time, we need to provide a certain level of transparency so as to encourage public confidence in both the process and the results. These two things might seem to be a little bit in conflict, or at the very least present unique challenges to both investigators and our community. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to steps that you will take to preserve the confidentiality of witness statements and other evidence. And one other question I had, you mentioned that you have a large team of lawyers who will be involved in this investigation. I just want to confirm that your conflict process has been undertaken as to all those lawyers who will be involved in the investigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me address the first issue about confidentiality. Maybe Angela can then address the conflict issue. We deal with high profile matters on a daily basis and routinely, and our lawyers understand, and we will remind them of the need for confidentiality in these matters. We certainly understand that we will not be trying this case or investigating it in the press, and we'll work with the committee to both balance the need for confidentiality and the need for transparency. I'm hoping that today's committee meeting goes a long way to making clear to the public exactly what processes are being followed, whether it relates to conflicts, whether it relates to our relationship to the committee, whether it relates to the scope of our investigation. There certainly is a need for transparency, but in the day-to-day operation of the investigation, confidentiality is vitally important. And I think both as lawyers in the government and our various roles and as lawyers in private practice, we are particularly understanding and sensitive to that need, but I certainly appreciate that question. I'll turn things over to Angela just to follow up on the question that our other lawyers working on these matters have also passed through the conflict process.
And the short answer is yes, we will ensure that anybody who's working on this matter will have been cleared from conflicts.
Thank you. Thank you, Angela, Greg, and Karen. I'm now going to call upon our colleague, Assemblymember Keith Brown.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you, Chairman Levine. Thank you, Ranker Montesano. I represent the 12th Assembly District from Long Island, and a couple of topics that I'd like to cover. I take this investigation very seriously. The seriousness is not lost on anyone. I'm happy to be surrounded by numerous excellent attorneys. Myself, I've been practicing for 25 years, litigated cases in both state and federal court. And just in terms of the task at hand, I see the role of this committee now changing into almost like a grand jury. And the question being whether or not the governor's conduct rises to willful and corrupt conduct during his time in office, and to determine whether or not to issue articles of impeachment. In terms of the integrity and of the process, and just want to make sure that we maintain the confidentiality in terms of the committee itself meeting in person, cell phones checked at the door, no materials leaving the room, utilizing private emails only to ensure that there's no dissemination of any confidential materials whatsoever. And the last point I'd like to make is with respect to the allegations, you know, the scope, I understand it's all on the table, but just to be more specific and to drill down, with respect to the nursing home deaths, and specifically the executive order 202.10, with regard to the specified immunity that was granted to nursing home operators, and whether there's any correlation to any contributions to political campaigns to that effect. Secondly, is the book deal that was signed. Then under the guise of the sexual harassment claims, we now have nine women in both in the administration and outside the administration that have come forward. Then there's the convalescent home deaths. There's the new Tappan Zee Bridge issue. Then political contributions in exchange for certain legislation. And then I also have on my list threatening, bullying, and berating members of the state legislature. And last but not least is interference or obstruction of justice with the investigation. So I want to thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Keith. I don't know if any of our counsel wish to respond.
As to the meeting and the manner in which we meet, we obviously, as I mentioned earlier, will take direction from the committee as to both the timing and place and location of those meetings and any of the particulars of those. So we're happy to work with the committee on those issues. Certainly understand the need and the importance of keeping the committee aware of the investigation and taking its direction throughout this process.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you again, Keith. Assemblymember Marjorie Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mostly, Assemblymember Walsh delved into the question that I was interested in, and that I'll just reiterate is the importance if we're ultimately called upon to judge the credibility and believability of witnesses before we make any findings to be reported to the assembly floor, that it is important to be able to see any audio or videotapes that may have been taken, because seeing a person, evaluating them, is a whole lot different than, as we all know, just reading a report on a piece of paper. So I would just reiterate the comments made by Ms. Walsh and strenuously ask that we have those documentation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Marjorie. Points well taken. We will next hear from our colleague, Tom Abinanti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the three lawyers for joining us. You guys come from a very distinguished firm and have very distinguished backgrounds. I have confidence in your abilities, but I think we have to deal directly with an issue that the press is asking. We can't dance around it. To instill confidence in the public, we have to hit it directly. There's a question of a combination of bias, a possibility, and conflict of interest. And the issues have come around. Being from Westchester County, I'm very familiar with Dennis Glazer and his reputation in the community. Also, one of your team is a member of a counsel to an OCA committee where the chief judge is involved. Please address those two. Is Dennis Glazer involved with your firm? Do any of you guys socialize with him, talk with him, deal with him? Will he be in any way come into relationship with the three of you? I think you have to assure the public on that issue, and we need to know for sure right up front. And secondly, the OCA matter. Maybe one of the one of you who's on there should take a leave from that until this investigation is over, because the chief judge is going to be sitting. If we come back with an impeachment resolution, the chief judge is going to be sitting. Now, secondly, I would like to make sure that the committee members are involved in the investigation and in discussions with you in a one-on-one situation, where the members want to do so and where appropriate. For example, I am from Westchester County. I've had a lot of dealings with some of the people who are involved in the governor's office today. And when you talk to me and maybe talk to some of the other Westchester Assembly members, we can give you some guidance as to the personalities of those people, introduce you to their style, what to expect when you deal with them, et cetera. And similarly, for example, the chair of our health committee has been very involved in the nursing home situation. He can provide you with information, I'm sure, that will speed up your investigation. So I would hope that we have an opportunity to work with you, not interfere with what you're doing, but to be involved as we go along. The Tappan Zee Bridge, for example, I've already started to do some investigation on that because it's in my district and I've been practicing law for 50 years. So I'm kind of like used to, you know, what's going on here. So that's the two points is one, I would hope that you would, I'd like to hear your answer with respect to the conflict of interest slash bias situation with Glazer and that committee. And secondly, get some assurances that we will have some access to you, not to interfere, but to have some conversation and give you information. Lastly, I'd like to add to the list of matters to investigate. There is a lot of concern that people with special needs have been put in the same situation as those in nursing homes. And we can have a conversation on that offline, but there are some orders that are still extant, which put people with special needs in group homes in danger. And it's very different directives than anybody else in the state.
Thank you very much for your question, and I'm very pleased to address the first two issues that you raised with respect to first Dennis Glazer. I think as it has been reported in the media, Dennis Glazer retired from the partnership back in 2012, and since then has not had any involvement in the firm's business or activities, and certainly not with respect to this matter, has he, nor will he, going forward. I think as Chair Levine recognized, a number of leading ethicists have opined on this issue and have found that there is no conflict, and nor do we believe that there's any conflict of interest there. The second question that you raised with respect to the committee, and I have served as the pro bono counsel for the Justice Task Force of the State of New York, which was originally created by Chief Judge Lipman back in 2009. And its mission was to study wrongful convictions and to propose remediations that would help lessen the likelihood of wrongful convictions in the future. The task force includes many prosecutors and prosecutors' offices around the state, district attorney's offices, police officers, victim rights advocates across the state. And it is chaired, the committee is chaired by Honorable Paul Feinman of the Court of Appeals. He currently serves as the chair, and the co-chairs are former Judge Siperic, as well as Judge Deborah Klein, who's the administrative judge for the New York Supreme Court. The work that we do on the task force is to really study potential issues. We are currently looking at the issue of racial and other biases in the criminal justice system. And typically what the Justice Task Force does is to create a report and recommendations, which it submits, including to the Office of Court Administration, which is made public. So that is the I think the body that you're referring to. And I don't think in any way whatsoever does that create a conflict or lessen the objectivity and the fairness that the three of us would bring to this very important investigation. And then with respect to your last comment about, you know, keeping the committee informed, I think as we have already addressed today, that we view that as an important part of our work, and would absolutely we would absolutely welcome your thoughts as we proceed with the investigation and trying to harness the benefit of the committee's considerable experience in these types of matters.
Yeah, I think there has to be a process for interaction. And not involving the rest of the committee, maybe individual members who have information that we would like to share with you, which doesn't have to go to the whole committee, but make it easier for you.
Tom, I want to thank you for your question. Angela, I want to thank you for your answer. And Angela, I also want to thank you for your work on the Justice Task Force, which is so important. Our next question will come from, or series of questions, will come from our colleague, Assemblymember Marcella Matanes.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair. You know, we are in historic times. Our everyday folks are expecting transparency and accountability from their elected officials. And with that, I also want to say I am not an attorney, but it's important since folks are listening to us that we explain what's happening. With that, I just want a little bit more clarity on how we're going to be working together with attorneys. Are we going to be working in lockstep with them, or are they just reporting to us and then we're making decisions? If during the investigation something new comes up, we discover something and it possibly rises to the level of a crime, what comes next? And lastly, if you can just explain what is going to be the beginning, or what are the first steps that we're going to be taking? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. We view our role as important to be interacting with the committee on whatever basis or timeframe that the committee requires. So whether that's on a weekly basis, or if we if committee members want us to make ourselves available on, you know, particular days so that we can have discussions, we certainly will do that, and we'll make every effort to be in constant contact. We view ourselves as doing this together for the committee and as the committee's lawyers. In terms of beginning steps, generally speaking, while we've done some work in terms of scoping our investigation, that is deciding the areas where we'll focus, as the chairman mentioned early on, there are specific issues that we've been tasked with looking at, and we'll start there. One of the initial steps that are always taken in the course of an investigation is to preserve any existing evidence so that it's not destroyed, and so that we have access to it. So first we'll be talking about asking relevant parties and individuals to preserve documents, and we'll follow up very quickly with requests for those documents. We'll use those documents and other public reporting that's available to start determining an outline for interviews and other investigative plans. It's important for us, as I said, to first preserve those documents, and that I believe will be and has been one of the initial steps we've taken.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Marcella. Assemblymember Michael Tanousis.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, I know that someone mentioned earlier that this investigation may take several months. My question is to the three attorneys, is that obviously the Attorney General's office has already interviewed a few of the accusers. The federal authorities have already started an investigation as well. Is there a concern that a report will come out from another investigative body before the assembly is able to adequately put something together to present to the floor of the assembly?
Sure, thanks for that question. I wouldn't say so much as a concern that there may be a report that's issued prior to our work being done. I think it's more of a recognition that there's a parallel process happening. We don't have control over that process, when that report would come out or not, and we won't necessarily gear our investigation solely on the timing of that report. I think we want to be aware of it to the extent possible. I think we want to be in discussions with the different investigators, whether on the state side or the federal side, primarily to make sure we're not interfering with their investigation, and to let them know to the extent possible what we're doing so that they're not interfering with ours. I think that is a concern that everybody involved in the various investigations shares. We don't want to interfere with one another's investigation. So we certainly have to be aware that those other investigations are happening. We have to have discussions to the extent that they're appropriate to make sure there's no interference. And I think we have to just understand that at some time, there will in fact be a report from the, at least from the New York Attorney General's office.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Michael. Now I'm going to call upon our colleague, Assemblymember Michael Norris.
Thank you very much, Chairman Levine, and I've had a pleasure working with you on the Ethics Committee and as Chairman of the Elections Committee, and I know you're a great person who will do a great job with this, and we appreciate your integrity in this process. In terms of the process itself, though, I'm curious to hear from the lawyers, what is the size of your team? Do you have investigators on the team? What are their credentials in terms of properly vetting witnesses? And also, just in terms of that, when it comes to a time that we do not, they may not cooperate with you, what will be the procedure that you request the committee or the chair to issue subpoenas to make sure that we get the relevant information that we need? And that's my main question in terms of the process, the scope, and what process you will take to ask us and the chair to issue subpoenas if needed. I also just want to reemphasize the need for full transparency and openness with all members of the committee. And I'm very confident you'll be doing that. We've had a great relationship with the chairman already on this, but it is very important that all members of this committee does receive all of the relevant information from this law firm and on a regular basis. So with that, I'll wait for your response. And thank you very much for your service.
And thank you for that question. I believe currently there may be as many as a half dozen other lawyers on our team. As the chairman mentioned, we've been at it for a little less than a week, and that team will grow as necessary and as the needs of the investigation require. We anticipate having substantially a larger team. We just haven't gotten there yet in terms of dividing up responsibilities and the like. But we have, as I said, I believe at least six or more other attorneys who are working for us, all at different levels of seniority. In terms of requests for witness interviews or subpoenas, if you will, or compulsion to the extent that that's necessary, those are all issues that we will consider. They vary among the different witnesses and the different work streams in terms of compulsion. We want to be very sensitive about whether we would compel somebody to come and testify, particularly on the victim side. That's not an area that we'd like to go to, and Martine can address that. But those are all issues within our sort of toolbox, if you will, and we'll consider each of those as it pertains to the different work streams. And again, you know, most importantly, we'll consider those not separate and apart from the committee, but in consultation with the committee and take input and direction from the committee about how to pursue those. But we certainly want to have all of the available options on the table for us in terms of pursuing our investigation. And as those different challenges come, we'll have discussions with you and the members of the committee about how to address those issues.
Thank you very much, Mr. Andes. And I was pointing my questions more towards the current administration, both current and past officials, and documents that are related to certain things like the nursing homes, for example. So more in line to that area than even on the others. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg. And Michael, let me say this. Assemblymember Michael Norris, it's an honor always to be able to work with you. And I think if there's a one message that this proceeding, this meeting portrays, it's that there is great cooperation and a great sense of respect between the Republican members and the Democratic members. And that's as it should be. Good work, my friend. All right, we are left now with 4 minutes. And so I'm going to ask my colleague, Michael Montesano, to sum up, if you will, in a very short period of time. Michael?
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for arranging this meeting and thank the attorneys from Davis, Polk, and Wardwell for being here today to answer our questions and address our concerns. I would just reiterate on my request for the reports, you know, in a expeditious manner, you know, deposition transcripts. And I'm really pleased with, you know, the progress we're going to be making. And, you know, we look forward on both sides of the aisle to working with the attorneys from Davis, Hulk, and Wardwell. And I hope we have a fair and balanced investigation. Thank you.
Michael, thank you very much. And let me thank Angela, Greg, Martine, all my colleagues on the committee, all the staff who put this together. This has been, in my estimation, a fascinating meeting, and I'm glad that the public has been able to participate. I want the record to reflect that, although the record to reflect that sounds kind of overly formal, but we have circulated amongst all the committee members some documents, copies of Article 6, Section 24 of the state constitution, portions, pertinent portions of the judiciary law. Also of interest, but I don't think it's included in the package, is Article 13, Section 5 of the state constitution, which has as well to do with the question of impeachment, and a fascinating law review article at the Fordham Urban Law Journal, Volume 15, Number 3, from 1987 by former Senators John Dunn and Michael Balboni on the history of the trial of Governor Sulzer, William Sulzer, in 1913. So that's 108 years ago. And it's an issue that is still being discussed. And it's really important information for us all to know on the committee and the public as well. The questions we deal with are so incredibly profound. The impeachment question is of tremendous significance. And I can't help but think that 108 years from now, and even longer than 108 years from now, people will be concerned and will study what it is that we as a state legislature are doing. I again want to thank all of my colleagues for remaining judicious, for not expressing opinions with respect to guilt or lack of guilt on the question of impeachment. That is critically important. It is an essential component of our American due process. Again, I thank everyone involved, and this draws our meeting to a close. We will have another meeting tomorrow morning at 9:30 of the Judiciary Committee, and I certainly hope all the public who are watching today will attend that meeting as well, although we will only be dealing with one piece of proposed legislation, and that legislation is Ken Zebrowski's bill having to do something with interest rates. So sounds pretty interesting. We will see you all tomorrow. I hear a motion to adjourn. That motion is granted. Everyone be well. Stay safe, and thank you so much. And thanks to the public for listening as well. Take good care, everyone.